It's been a chaotic week on both sides of the Atlantic. As Britain gets to grips with its rather strange new political reality, a deepening sense of crisis is taking hold across the United States. We'll assess how the print sector rises to the challenge of such turbulent times today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Coming up later in the show, we'll find out how one Swiss editor refused to give the oxygen of publicity to those responsible for the recent terror attack here in London, using some rather unusual methods.
As a newspaper, as a printed newspaper, we thought, well, we have to make a stop and we have to show that we have a problem in how we deal with terrorism in our media.
Our programme today focuses on the changing role of print media during turbulent times. Here in London, the city is still coming to terms with the aftermath of last week's attack at London Bridge and the Borough Market, which killed 8 people and injured many more. Simon Jenkins is a newspaper columnist here in London and was formerly editor of The Times. He believes that the response to incidents of terror among the British media, including its newspapers, often comes with unintended consequences. He talked about this to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield.
I think it's quite simply over-publicising it. We all know, it's embedded in terrorism law, that the purpose of terrorism is not just to kill people, it's to kill people plus publicity. The publicity is the force. It's 90% of the effect of terrorism. There wouldn't be terrorist acts if it wasn't for the publicity. You very rarely get them in dictatorships. I believe that the press, uniquely in these circumstances, has to think, what is the effect of my publicity on this particular act? And it is to terrorize people. There's no other way of describing it. And I just think the press ought to be very restrained in reporting it.
And yet, is there a potential problem for the press that they would then end up covering up things that the public need to know?
There is no conceivable way you could describe the coverage of terrorist acts in London over the past month as covering up.
No, sure, but if you were to not cover it in this way and actually not reveal quite as much.
Newspapers make a choice about how to cover things. They can cover them a little, a lot, or an inordinate amount. These are choices. They're choices you make according to how far you value the story, what the competitive news might be. All these things go into the decision as to how much to cover. 5, 10, 15 pages every day for a week, which happened after Westminster, is totally ridiculous to me. It was repetitive. There was very little new news, ever. It was simply saying the same thing over and over again. It was squeezing every inch of sort of human agony they could possibly get out of it, which is exactly what the terrorists want. Everything we know about terrorism is that that is what they want you to do. We're just doing it. There's no danger of it being suppressed. It should not be suppressed. That would be quite wrong. But this is not suppression is so far from what we're doing. It really is.
The way that these attacks are covered now is very different from how, in particular, IRA attacks were covered in the 70s, 80s and early 90s. Why do you think that has changed?
I honestly think it cannot be interpreted any other way than pure sensationalism. The desperation with which the BBC every night tries to get someone to cry on camera, I just find obscene. It's almost pornographic, the grief. It is relentless, it's repetitive, it's not new. There's no novelty about it. It is simply wallowing in other people's misery. It just doesn't seem to me this is necessary to cover the story.
How then should we cover these sorts of atrocities? What is the right level, you think?
I think we should cover them. I know it's not quite the same as a stabbing in South Croydon, but the fact is more people die from stabbings in South Croydon than died in any of the terrorist incidents in central London. Just because they're in central London doesn't mean they've got to be carried at 1,000 times the intensity of South Croydon. But there is no reason for not carrying them as atrocities, as deaths, as tragic events. It's quite right that the city should, in some sense, grieve with those people who've suffered, because it is, in a sense, a city grieving for an attack on the city. That's quite different from day after day after day. Not covering the police response, not covering the security implications, but simply covering the grief. And I just find that over the top.
You edited The Times in the early 1990s. Did you have moments when you were editing that newspaper where you had decisions to make about covering violent acts or deaths where you now look back and you think, we should have given that more prominence, or I feel we went over the top?
It's difficult to think back to individual incidents. It really is. All I know
but
is...
Was it something you battled with at that
time?
Oh,
yes. There's no question. We decided. you decide how much coverage to give a story. For instance, to take the example of Le Monde in the Paris outrages, Le Monde decided not to publicise the names of the people who did it. That was a deliberate decision to deny them the publicity, the sensationalism, the martyrdom they craved. They were accused of censorship. I think it was a very brave decision. They simply said, we're not going to give these people the publicity they craved in doing the act. We're not going to become, in effect, accessories after the act. They were almost accomplices, the people who publicised those people. You were simply doing things that they wanted you to do in order to have them glorified among those people who supported them. I can think back to many cases when you made decisions. People assume that what goes into a newspaper is inevitable. It's not. It's always the result of a decision made by the staff. And I just think that the staff decisions now being made about terrorist acts in London are grossly counterproductive, also very damaging to the London economy.
Do you think this could change in the future? Because, you know, we've got, things have changed from how they were in the past. We have, as you argue, become more amenable to the idea of sensationalism. Can you see newspaper editors or editors at the BBC and other news networks thinking, actually, that let's take this back a notch?
I don't know. I advocate a protocol in which the Press Complaints Commission or some such body actually brings together editors and says, look, we're not discussing censorship, we're discussing self-censorship. We are discussing what is the appropriate way to handle stories like this, because it's abundantly clear that we are playing the terrorist game. And I think that's the appropriate way of going about it. I think there should be some sort of concordat, which simply says we're going to show restraint, some sort of restraint. All I know at the moment is there's no restraint and there's no concordat.
Simon Jenkins there, speaking to Monocle's Steve Bloomfield.
Each week on The Foreign Desk, we take a look at a single story, we find two or three great guests, and then we try to work out what's going on. It might be the story that's dominating the news that week.
The main thing they wanted to do was to stop, to get rid of Obama. How are you going to negotiate with that?
It might be something we think everyone else is ignoring.
Children, elderly, it doesn't matter. Anybody that is leaving the country is going to be shot.
Either way, the format's the same. Guests who know their stuff, talking knowledgeably, so that you and me end up knowing a little bit more than we did before. That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time and available at any time on monocle.com.
Simon Jenkins is not alone in his critique of the British media's response to incidents of terror. Philip Saib is Professor of Journalism and Public Diplomacy at the University of Southern California. Shortly after the recent bombing at a concert in Manchester, here in the United Kingdom, Professor Saib wrote about what he saw as the disappointing lack of complexity in press coverage. He spoke to Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco earlier.
The problem with covering terrorist attacks is that the media, whether it's print or broadcast or any form of media, tend to focus on the event itself and don't provide much context. I mean, all these terrorist attacks we've had, they don't exist in isolation. And I think the public kind of gets swept away by the details and the horror of the particular attack. But the news media need more to help the public put those attacks in context and better understand how to address them.
In a way, I think you mentioned in one of your pieces, there's a lack of complexity in this coverage as well, because, you know, sometimes it's quite, superlative. You know, they just talk about the numbers, the emotions, but they're not analysing the reasons why this is happening. They don't give, for example, the religion Islam. They don't explain things properly to their readers in some ways, correct?
Well, that's right. The coverage is very episodic, but terrorism is much more than just individual episodes. It's a phenomenon that affects the entire world and is very complex. And I think the news media owe it to their audiences to explain that complexity so the public can better deal with these attacks.
You're based in the United States. Do you think there is a difference, or do you think that, you know, the print media in general in the U.S. and Europe is quite similar, the way they cover those attacks?
I think they are fairly similar, although, for example, the recent attacks in the U.K. have been more intensively covered, certainly by the British news media, because it is more of a local story. But there's a certain consistency and some certain common flaws in the coverage, regardless of the nationality of the news organization.
And I would like to ask, I mean, perhaps there is none, but do you think there is a media organization, again, more specifically on print media, that actually is doing a good job, perhaps, on the way they cover those things?
I think some of the print media, The Economist, for example, probably is a little more thoughtful than some of the other news organizations. But I think it's a consistent problem. And until you get into some of the really specialized news organizations that deal specifically with terrorism, and most of these are online publications, you find the same kind of shallowness. There are some individual reporters who know a lot about terrorism, and their coverage reflects that. But for the most part, it tends to be too sensational, I think. And these are sensational events because that's what the terrorists want. They want to terrorize. They don't just want to kill people. They want to terrorize millions more. And there's no getting away from that. You can't play down the fact that innocent people are being slaughtered. But at the same time, I think it behooves the news organizations to look at the big picture and say, look, we have to deal with this. It's not going to go away by itself. Here are the things our government should be doing. Here are things the public should know. And I think a bit more leadership from the news media would be helpful.
Philip Tsai, Professor of Journalism and Public Diplomacy at the University of Southern California, in conversation with Monocle's Fernando Augusto Pacheco.
They've reported, listened, watched, quizzed and cajoled. They've been to farms and galleries, conclaves and bars. They've reported from the high north and tropical metropolises. And you? Well, all you need to do is turn the dial, click our app, or pop in your headphones and head off on an audio tour of the spikiest, juiciest, funniest moments from Monocle 24's Week That Was. The Curator is our one-hour show that informs, entertains and surprises with the best bits of all our magazine shows, from The Urbanist to The Menu, The Stack to The Entrepreneurs, Culture to Section D, premiering live every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time. You can also subscribe to the programme at monocle.com or on iTunes or on SoundCloud to ensure that you never miss a beat. Come on, let's catch up this weekend. Listen to The Curator.
You're listening to The Stack on Monocle 24, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. We're focusing today's programme on how the printed press reacts and responds to terror. I'm happy to say I'm joined now by a good friend of Monocle 24, Shashank Joshi, Research Fellow at the Royal United Services Institute for War and Conflict. Shashank, thanks for being on the programme.
Thanks for having me.
Let's just talk about this rather awkward area where the media's coverage of terror, well, it's constantly assessed and reassessed in the aftermath of each of these dreadful attacks. Mm. And there seems to have been, again, a fresh voicing of this opinion that by covering the detail, the granular detail, be it people's identities, their backstories, you somehow provide a template for the next budding wannabe jihadi. Where do you stand on that point? And how does what the press in particular say about an attack shape the actual security situation?
I think the biggest issue is sensationalism, the degree to which they provoke fear and alarm. And I think we don't realise how lucky we have it in terms of our politicians. We only realised it in this last few weeks, the period of the last two attacks, when a US president sought to encourage panic and fear and criticised the mayor of London for not doing enough to be fearful and panicky. So my issue is with the way we talk about the threat level, the risk, the level of personal risk, the degree to which this affects us individually, how scared we should be. That I think the press is getting better at. I don't have a problem with covering attackers' names, their backstories. And look, as a defense analyst, as a terrorism analyst, I think it's critical we have to understand their backstories. For example, if we didn't do that, how else would we know that these attackers were linked to the Al-Muhajirun network, which in turn was connected to Anjem Chaudhary, which in turn was a major problem for our counterterrorism policy because we weren't able to prosecute him? So we as the public have to know those details. I think you cover them in a responsible way that doesn't glorify the individuals.
Now, there's a delicate balance, though, isn't there, Shashank, to strike there? Because if you look at the detail and assess what could be perceived by some to be security failings or signposted ideas that then aren't pursued, whether it's an affiliation with a particular mosque or a particularly aggressive group, that in itself, covering those potential failures, does surely contribute to the public's sense of risk or danger. Is it possible to present all of those facts objectively and not prompt people to be fearful that perhaps the security services aren't following all the right people or don't understand the complexities of all the networks you've described?
It's incredibly hard, and obviously our media landscape is very fragmented. Different outlets handle this problem in very different ways, some of them much more responsibly than others, the broadsheets infinitely more responsibly and carefully than the tabloids, as we'd expect on pretty much any issue. I think you raise a very interesting question as to how they talk about the failings of the security service. I certainly am fascinated by the trope of intelligence failures. Now, intelligence failures can occur. They do occur. We let one of the London Bridge attackers back into the country despite him being on a Schengen watch list. That is a serious failure, and we have to address that. What you don't get is the context. You don't get the context of what did the security services know at the time. And when people say X or Y tipped off the security services or the authorities, I always say, look, the UK's anti-terrorism hotline got 20,000 calls in the year to March. The Prevent programme has thousands of referrals. MI5's subjects of interest, there are 3,000 people, and there are 23,000 former subjects of interest. Only by understanding the size of that haystack can the public hope to understand the risk they're exposed to and the challenge faced by the security services.
Now, it's interesting there. You mentioned the sort of better end of the newspaper spectrum, for example. But newspapers are, almost by their very definition, going to be political. They're going to have editors, they're going to have proprietors in many cases who have a clear political agenda. Does that matter? Does it necessarily mean that it's more difficult for a reader or any layman to understand how to weight the information they're receiving? Or is it actually perfectly acceptable in your view that these very complex matters are addressed across a political spectrum as well within the pages of the papers? I mean, is it a frustration when, for example, you can see how something that maybe you understand a little better is presented in a jaundiced way, be it by the right or the left of the spectrum?
I absolutely. And look, counterterrorism is political. It must be political. It's about our rights, our securities, the powers the state has over us. But when it's covered in the usual partisan political way in the newspapers, that is a problem. And I think we saw examples of that in the past week with Theresa May suggesting she would rip up human rights laws if it helped her protect the public. And of course, terrorism experts and those who understand policy recognize she has the power to designate people under terrorism prevention and investigation measures, or so-called TPIMs. She can say to someone, you have to move 200 miles away from your house, stay overnight at this address, use only a designated computer and phone, and only meet with these people, and you can't talk to the media. Those powers exist, and she's only used them. Right now, there are only 7 TPIMs in force. Now, when it's framed as a human rights stop me from engaging in the counterterrorism I need to do, and because that fits into a broader political debate about the ECHR and European legislation and the Human Rights Act, which is a broad, well-understood political dichotomy, it completely confuses the facts at stake. And unfortunately, I've seen very few outlets. The BBC have done very well at this, I should say, at actually presenting the granular details of policy in a responsible way.
Shashank, let's just come back to the press then. What is their power? I mean, particularly if we look at it through a UK prism, we're talking about the global picture, but particularly in the light of the London Bridge attack. Do the newspapers in particular actually have the power to, in this respect, do good or do bad? Ultimately, is it within their gift to aid the security and intelligence agencies, to aid those like yourself who are analysing all of this, to improve the situation? Or can they, through reckless reporting or jingoism, do real damage? Or actually, is their power rather inflated often by themselves?
I think to the extent that they spread the message of panic, they both encourage overreaction in policy, and they undermine the trust in government that is the aim of terrorism. I have to say, I think this problem is far more severe at the level of international terrorism than it is for domestic acts. And that's partly because the domestic terrorism we have seen, Westminster attack, the Manchester attack, the London Bridge attack, it hasn't had the characteristic aesthetic of terrorism. You know, terrorism is propaganda of the deed in a way that maximizes that propaganda effect. Compare that to Islamic State in Syria and Iraq, as we've discussed many times over the years. Their glossy HD videos filmed from multiple angles with a sort of iconography of fear, orange jumpsuits, victims who are submissive and helpless, all of it designed, you know, with English language, London-accented terrorists speaking to us. That is really worrying. And the media was covering that in very dangerous ways, putting those pictures, you know, with victims kneeling on the front pages of papers. And I think they accepted the aesthetics and the publicity of the terrorists on those occasions. In these recent attacks, they haven't had the same opportunity. There haven't been videos, there haven't been a sort of fancy set-piece speeches to camera, which has made the task easier, I think. All we have is grainy footage. We have reports of someone being kicked out of their mosque. And, of course, all of that is the right way to report it. These are sort of people on the fringes of society. We're not showing them at their most glossy.
Shashank Joshi, absolutely fascinating to speak with you, as always. Thanks very much for talking to us on The Stack.
It's the show presented by me, Andrew Tuck, all about the cities we live in. The show that celebrates urban living, from tough-talking mayors and civic activists to the guy who runs a perfect neighbourhood shop and the woman who, come sunset, turns into a gorilla gardener. The Urbanist is the go-to show for anyone who wants to know what makes a great city, and also a rubbish one, and how good lighting or wise technology could shape their metropolis for the better. Join us every week for sparkling debate, global reports, and some agenda-setting interviews.
We have a chance to shape what the urban environment will be like for billions of people.
The show premieres live every Thursday, or you can subscribe to the programme as a podcast at monocle.com or on SoundCloud or iTunes. The Urbanist, the programme that knows its good mayors from its planning nightmares.
Finally, today on The Stack, we're touching down in Switzerland, where one editor has thrown out the rulebook on how newspapers cover those responsible for terrible terrorist crimes. Many papers published by NZZ declined to feature the names or pictures of the London attackers, instead printing grey blocks in memoriam to those who lost their lives. Editor-in-chief of NZZ Regional Titles, Pascal Hollenstein, explained his decision.
Yeah, actually we were talking about this kind of thing since probably 1 month or so, and we just had the feeling that we have a little bit of routine in covering these terrorist attacks. And it's not only the routine we have as journalists, you know, always starting with push news alerts and then, you know, the news tickering and all that stuff. It's also the routine, you know, in our audience. We found out that people are not really interested anymore in what we are doing. So we are losing clicks in the internet. And as a newspaper, as a printed newspaper, we thought, well, we have to make a stop and we have to kind of, you know, show that we have a problem in how we deal with terrorism in our media. And that's basically the point why we decided after the London attack, now it's time, now we do it.
And Pascal, give us a sense of the reaction that your readers, whether they're digital or whether they're reading the paper copy of your products, what was their reaction like? Did they find that refreshing? Did they like the fact that you were challenging some of that status quo?
Actually, I have to say I was a little bit afraid of the reaction when we did it and when we decided it, and I didn't sleep very well at night. But on the next day, I got roughly about 116 emails from readers directly to me, a lot more to other employees of our company. And of the 160 emails, I had only two critics of the action, and you would say 158 that were perfectly happy and congratulating.
Which is a pretty good ratio. What about the questions, though, Pascal? I'm sure people ask you this, and they'll say, look, the role of the media in a democracy is to report the facts objectively so that people can make their own opinions. I mean, presumably, you mentioned your sleepless night. That was one of the things you were wrestling with. You know, how difficult is it for editors and the people who are making papers to kind of take that out of the picture and go with something that's more a bit more of an op-ed sort of treatment?
Look, we are going to report facts, and it was just a single point in history of our newspaper. We said we have to make a stop, and we have to talk about what are we doing here, and what is this? How is this affecting our society? How is this affecting our, the impact of terror also on our society? But sure, we have to go on reporting. On the other hand, it's not just reporting of facts. We also have to say what is important. And for example, there was a big media outlet in Switzerland that was doing at that day a push alert that the number of victims has risen from 6 to 7 people, which is incredibly sad. But, you know, politically, it's not important whether it's 6, 7, 8, or 10. It doesn't matter.
And Pascal, tell me about this. We're hearing from different voices on our programme this week, and there are some very harsh critics of the media who say that by, for example, naming the terrorists straight away or by covering their attacks in detail instantly, that's giving oxygen, the oxygen of publicity. It's giving the aggressors, these criminals, it's giving them what they want. What do you make of that? Those sorts of comments? Clearly there's a balance to be struck, but do you think that those are misjudged and that fundamentally the press is doing its role and it's fulfilling its function, which, as we've mentioned in a democracy, is fundamental?
I think you can't talk about the press as the press. Every editor every day has to take his own decision. And sure, I think the criticizers have a point if they say, for example, if you portray these call them bloody assholes who commit these kind of crimes, that you're creating kind of a role model for people who probably would also do the same. We know that also from coverage, for example, of suicide. You know, every time you're writing about a suicide, you have people who are going to do the same. They just copy it. And you construct a role model of heroism by describing every detail of these deeds and even showing pictures of these perpetrators. So what I want to say is just we should concentrate on the political aspects. We should put our brain power where we really need brain as journalists into the political aspects. How do we deal with radicalized Muslims? How do we avoid the things like that happen? How can we cope with integration of these parts of the society rather than covering completely senseless details of these really cruel and attacks?
Pascal Hollenstein from the Swiss newspaper NZZ, regional titles, editor-in-chief of those. Absolutely fascinating to speak with you. Thank you so much, Pascal, for your insights, and thanks for being on the programme.
Thank you.
And that's all we have time for on this week's edition of The Stack. Thanks to our production team of Ben Rylan and Fernando Augusto Pacheco and our editor, Claire Urban. Comments or queries are welcome as always. Get in touch with Fernando. His email is fp@monocle.com. This is The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thank you very much for listening.